Okay, this is the hour. We call it Conversations with Linda. We'll take your phone calls. Anything goes next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Linda Moultonow with us. That's just fascinating, that kind of propulsion system, Linda.
Isn't it? And can't you just begin to feel the palpable sense that it's coming, it's going to be real,
yeah.
That if we can get past the tribal warfare on Earth, that the excitement of literally getting out into the solar system and having a three-minute phone call between Mars and Earth, somehow bringing the solar system tighter together, and that the idea that humans could have two planets in the system is now not just science fiction.
It is amazing, truly. And it makes me really understand that the UFO visitations are probably being done. They have learned another form of technology beyond this one, and that is probably bending space and time together.
Exactly. I heard that from a man who was working on ring lasers at MIT and did work with Wright-Patterson, and back in 1983-84 time period, he told me very straightforwardly that he had firsthand knowledge that we were dealing with other intelligences in this universe so advanced that they really could bend space-time and move point to point. And he referenced, it's now, I think, kind of a classic explanation, but it is, imagine, let's say that you have a napkin at a table, and it's made out of cloth, and you lift it up, and you want to go from one corner to the other corner, and that it is the napkin that I'm describing on the table is the universe. That's the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And that the advanced intelligence can be on one corner, and it can be 13 billion light years to the opposite corner. And they can move, they can bend space, time.
Instantly.
Move point to point. And he, the MIT guy, said, and it's truly my understanding that some of these intelligences can literally be on one side of what we would call a door, and they are at, let's say, where they're leaving, and they walk through this incredible doorway, and they are 10, 13 billion light years away from where they were on the other side of
Amazing.
The door. And that it isn't even moving in spacecraft. I remember hearing people in the abduction syndrome years ago say, I think that we're dealing with something that doesn't even have to get into spacecraft, that they just walk through doors and they move from one end of the universe to the other. Well, that's at this high sophisticated level. But I think on Earth for a long time that there has been an alien presence, largely of androids, clones, hybrids, like doing work for something else that is highly advanced. But we are on a planet where whatever the presence is, so much of it seems to be in the android category, the clone category. And maybe we, none of us have yet encountered what the prime intelligence is behind the alien presence on our planet. This is an exciting time because as we start moving toward putting our foot on another planet, like for real, for building things like Mars, then maybe that is going to be a signal. Maybe that is what the universe waits for. And the signal will be that we're finally grown up enough to try to encounter some of these very advanced intelligences, which in my experience, it does not make sense that something that would be truly advanced, moving point to point, would be violent. I don't think that that necessarily goes together, meaning that some people say, oh, well, I'm scared of the idea of extraterrestrials. Well, if they are that advanced, I don't think you have anything to be scared of. I think we have a lot to learn.
Look how far we've advanced in terms of aviation travel in 100 years, Linda.
Just, oh, I know.
Jump us up 100 years from now. We may be at that bending space and time point.
And at Eureka Springs this coming Friday, or it's not this weekend, it's the next weekend.
It's the one after. Yeah.
It's on the 8th. And that night, Friday night, I'm the keynote speaker for 2 hours in the evening. And with that extra time, I'm going into symbols and binary code in high strangeness phenomena, because part of all of this, I think, is the issue of communication. And that over the last 30 or 40 years, there have been many cases in which the human mind can download information from something telepathically and then end up writing down zeros and ones or squares and ones, and it can be translated and has been, and that the binary code communications are fascinating because they seem to echo each other. I'm going to be presenting that at Eureka Springs on Friday the 8th in my keynote presentation. And it sets the stage for a whole new way of thinking about communication between intelligences, because math must be a kind of common language throughout the entire cosmos.
Yeah, it's got to be. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Stacy in Eureka, California, to get things started. Hi, Stace.
Hi. How are you doing this evening?
Good.
I would just like to start, because I'm sure that Linda will have something electrifying to say about this, by saying that there are several online petitions about this issue that I'm about to bring up.
Okay.
So I want to urge the listeners to please seek them out. I started one myself on change.org, but I'm calling about the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. It's located on 4 fault lines.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and, I think it's most likely our Fukushima, if we allow it to keep operating. Recently, one of the lead on-site inspectors blew the whistle and said that they are not complying with the safety rules set out for the plant's operation.
Yes. I completely thank you for this valuable phone call, because this is an issue that we all should be more educated about and paying attention to. And in fact, today I was talking with Scott Portzline, who you also know, George.
So and as a matter of fact, he's coming. He's my guest Thursday night.
Exactly. And he and I were talking about what I was reporting tonight on Fukushima, and we both have agreed that's something that is extremely important and we may be working on for COAST upcoming in 2 or 3 months, is the whole issue of what are vulnerable nuclear reactors in the United States right now, and what locally, what are residents doing, what are state governments, what is their perspective, and couple that with, in Belgium, the terrorist threat brought up the whole question. How vulnerable are nuclear power plants to ISIS terrorist attacks? And those are two areas that Scott Portzline and I are going to be working together on in the next 3 months or so. And that relates precisely to the question that you're raising, is that how vulnerable are nuclear power plants to having the same kind of a catastrophe in Fukushima, but in this case, an earthquake in California where the population is so dense and huge.
All right, more calls. Thanks, Stacy, for that. Let's go next to Brock in Friday Harbor, Washington, west of the Rockies. Brock, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you, George. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I love Linda, too. I love listening to you.
Thanks.
But I just got a quick question. If the spacecraft can go from the Earth to Mars in 25% the speed of light, what happens in the trajectory of going there if it hits a grain of sand?
Well, that's a very good question for me to ask Professor Lubin. And I don't have an answer for you right now.
Would it bounce off, or would it go right through the craft?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. These first prototypes will be small. And as I was saying, he's talking about the intelligence part, the one that would be sending and receiving data, would be about 4 inches in diameter, might look something like an iPhone, and that it would be in encased in a protection. And I will have this artwork up at Earth Files in the report tomorrow so you can all see it. He and I have been working on it, and it was just delayed. But I also have his interpretation of how the, we'll call it the round part, the disc part, that will be receiving the photons and being pushed. And it will act also, it will be the part that's being pushed away. And depending upon what it's made of, at first it will be very thin. It could be some sort of a very firm silica or silicon type of manufacturing, which a dust grain might not penetrate. And they probably have thought about this and are thinking about this. And I will find out tomorrow, and I will add it as an update to Earth Files. So go to earthfiles.com, and you'll see the illustrations, and I will make a note to find out from the professor about that question, what would happen if a dust grain interacted with one of these first wafer chip moving at 25 to 30% the speed of light. Thank you for that call.
We're with Linda Moulton Howe taking your questions. Let's go next to Thomas in La Jolla, California. Thomas, go ahead.
George, Nori, thank you for taking my call. And Linda, I just want to say that your work is superb. We need 10, 100 more journalists like you.
Thank you so much.
My question is expanding on this idea of communication. We know that there is an alien presence visiting Earth, and I'm pretty sure, in my opinion, that there are millions of civilizations out there in our galaxy. I'm pretty sure of that. But our radio telescopes here on Earth, all over the planet, do not pick up any communications. There's like a galactic radio silence, and that's puzzling. I mean, the question is, where is everybody, you know, if there's these civilizations out there? And I believe that they are out there. Consider that planet Earth has been broadcasting radio frequencies for 100 years. So anybody within 100 years, 100 light years of planet Earth would hear our communications. But yet, our radio telescopes worldwide do not pick up any transmissions. There's like this radio blackout, so to speak, and that's puzzling to me. And anyway, I know that those civilizations are out there, but why are they not broadcasting, you know, communications on the radio frequencies?
Right. I've had this same discussion with many different groups of people over the years. It is what Paul Davies at Arizona State University calls the eerie silence, and wrote a book about that question. I'm going to jump to the one discussion and possible hypothesis that I think makes perhaps some sense, and that is, when you come to the human abduction syndrome, the interaction with the non-humans is always telepathic, and there's no sound. Every once in a while, they will describe some sort of a, or click, click, click sound, mm-hmm. and it's not universal, but that's the only thing, not voices like we are used to. So the non-human interaction with humans is silent. It's telepathic. And if in the universe, in the cosmos, if the advanced intelligences aren't doing verbal communication, if that is the direction that higher intelligence has taken in this particular universe, and the civilizations that are the ones that we would like to make contact with. It's all telepathic, or it's in a frequency that is outside of our radio telescopes and our ears. It might explain why we're in a silent bubble, or it means that it's possible that there is something in the alien presence that wants to keep Earth isolated, insulated for some period of time for reasons that are still not clear. And that might be a reason we don't know it, we haven't understood it, that there's some sort of a filter bubble that might have been placed on this solar system. These are some of the thoughts that have come up in discussions with people, even in a scientist that I know, on exactly the question that you asked tonight. It's fascinating, and I think that if we can get past 2016 without some terrible nuclear war or something else happening, that we could be beginning to make the inroads on those kinds of questions with real data. If we could get these wafer craft going, that the University of California, Santa Barbara, they're chomping at the bit to get those getting out into the solar system and beyond and learning data. And if we can get to Alpha Centauri with one of our little droids from Earth, we might begin to get first-hand information about why we think it's a silent universe, when in fact it is probably teeming with life, even if it's telepath.
Linda, in the minute we have here before the break, Stephen Bassett continues to think that there's going to be full disclosure, whether Hillary gets elected, who knows what. I still don't think it'll come from government. What do you think?
It's a very good question. Could we pick that up on the other side of the break?
We will pick that up for sure.
Yeah.
And give folks your website, email addresses, and how they can get a hold of you. Are you on Facebook now?
Earth Files has Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and all of that.
Oh, beautiful.
And go to www.earthfiles.com. And in the upper right is the Facebook and the Twitter connections. And I always welcome email to earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter who files news about the Earth, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I always honor requests for confidentiality, but the goal is to learn facts and for me to try to report them.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe. We'll take your final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And those of you on hold, don't lose your place in line. We'll get right to you when we come right back. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, you might remember a year ago I had an exclusive interview. It went worldwide with the three-headed individual. We're going to chat with them again. Tom is working on getting me some new information, and I'm looking forward to that. Then we'll have our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, we're talking about disclosure, how I do not think it's going to come from government. If it comes at all, it'll be from whistleblowers. What are your thoughts?
At the upcoming Contact in the Desert, which is June 3rd through 6th in Joshua Tree.
I'll be there.
Yeah, and I'm going to be doing several lectures and workshops that relate to each other one after another in a way, and my mind in the way I'm putting them together. I'm going to be doing a taxonomy of ETs in one that includes an outline allegedly for President Ronald Reagan, and there is a presentation of a list of types. Five are listed, of which four are described as friendlies, and only one is a foe, but the foe is considered to be hostile. Then there is the question of how big is the biggest box that humans really are in all of this. And when I was working on the Home Box Office project back in 1983, It was the working title was UFOs, the ET Factor. And there was a person who crossed my path in that year that I think worked for an alphabet soup agency. And he told me, keep in mind the Greek gods weren't mythology. They are real ETs, and they fight. And he said, one of the big mysteries is Zeus and the Titans fought each other, but what did they fight over?
Yeah.
Linda, if we had the answer to that question, if you had the answer to that question, we might be able to understand what's happening. Well, that at the time, I had no context for what I just said to you. And now it's these many years later, and I've walked thousands more miles in all of this trying to understand the facts and the truth. And I think that fighting conflict, yin and yang, black and white, light and dark, all of it is a part of this universe, even though we would all like everything beyond Earth to be decent and rational and reasonable and no wars and everything wonderful. And I don't think that's realistic. So if you are in the government's shoes and you know that we are, I'm convinced we already have neutralizing gravity technologies in the black programs, that when Ben Rich said in the early 90s that we had the technology to take E.T. home, he was referencing the Spielberg movie, and he meant we have the ability. We probably in the black projects already have something that can go interstellar space, but the rest of the scientific world doesn't know that. All of that may be the bridge. The government is waiting to get a lot of this out in such a way that it's not going to shock the psyche of scientists and so forth. But I personally think that the non-humans may have a very logical reason for keeping us sheltered. Because if, in fact, this is true, if you just think about this for a minute, that Zeus and the Titans were extraterrestrial, real, and they fought each other, what did they fight over? Did they fight over humans, as Enlil and Enki were supposed to fight about in the Sumerian world of the Anunnakis as another group? And that over and over again, the thing that has always impressed me is the longer I have tried to go after the pressure of fact, I'm only interested in the truth, that the deeper I have gone, the longer I have persisted, the more the entire phenomena keeps coming into this area of human beings created to be like the avatar representatives of something else behind the matrix, and that there really is a matrix, and there really are forces behind it, and that the government may decide in a logical way that they're just going to wait until this generation and the next generation pass, and then by that point, it may be that we have the 25% to 30% light travel between Mars and the Earth and the rest of the solar system, and we're already becoming space travelers on our own when a bigger box will be allowed to be introduced to us. And when these facets are all put together, I find it exciting. I don't find it scary. I find all of this to be a reason to keep exploring and to leave behind war and darkness and hatred. We have to leave that.
Let's wrap up the segment with these calls now. Carl is in Milwaukee. Welcome to this program, Carl. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thanks to the Coast to Coast team for this wonderfully eclectic nightly forum for intelligent discourse.
Thank you, Carl.
And Linda, hi, Linda.
Yeah.
I get to check off something from my bucket list where I get to ask Linda a question. And, you know, Linda, you've been asked so many questions about chupacabras and Bigfoot and crop circles. Here's my question. Linda, if you, as busy as you are, as much as you travel, if you have a week of pure leisure, a vacation week, for all the places that you've traveled, where would you like to go back to and just relax and explore, and why?
How about that, Linda?
One of my most favorite places on the entire planet is Venice. And that's where I would go.
California or Italy?
No, sorry, Venice and Italy. And I think the reason is I've been there three times, and each time it had the same impact, even though it has the inundation of the water problem. It has an energy and a history that resonates with me so much, and that is that the beauty and the artistry that is represented there that humans produce on their very, the best part of humanity is expressed there. And the beauty is staggering, the boats and the water. And that when I know from the history that so much of our human history has been people trying to get away from, flee from oppression, flee from abuse, flee. That Venice is like this piece of light on the earth that has been there for a very long time, of a lot of people who were fleeing oppression, and then they created this incredible island that makes some of the most incredible art on the planet. And there is something about that that I hope could be the story for the whole world. I thought about this several times when I've been there, that if Venice can exist and even be always challenged by the water that laps everywhere, then the whole planet, I feel like we have the ability to get past this rough node that we are on, the timeline that feels so precarious and dangerous. And that is my greatest prayer. And so I would go back to Venice while it is still beautiful in here.
Mike is in Montreal. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Thanks so much, George and Linda.
Hi.
Boy, I had so many interesting points, but we're almost out of time, so I'll have to do some editing and make it down to two quick ones. firstly, in relation to Fukushima, a good friend of mine, actually my best friend for over 35 years, works with a scientist who developed a compound. It's a wax compound that absorbs radiation incredibly well. In fact, he proposed after Chernobyl, it's been around this long, after Chernobyl, he wanted to seal that thing off and prevent any radiation leakage from it, and he got no interest from anyone. And more recently, my best friend himself, after endless emails, phone calls, snail mail, everything he could do to try and contact somebody at the UN or anywhere, he went himself personally down to the UN in New York to deliver a package of information on how he could seal off Fukushima and prevent any radiation leakage. Nobody would talk to him. Nobody showed any interest. And that's what one of the things that really, really scares me about this world is, do they really want to fix anything?
Well, you're asking an interesting question in the context also of something that I run into, and I'm sure other people do too. So much science is dependent upon federal money. And labs can live or die on whether they keep getting lab research grants. So what I have found is that often anything that is new, that is outside of whatever the boundaries and the reasons for funding are for any given lab, it just won't even be touched. And I don't know how we change that, because what has happened is that the federal government and its biases good or bad, are now the what is the tail driving the dog of so much science.
Right. Point two that I wanted to make in relation to space travel, the fascinating, you know, the laser sail idea is a fascinating one. The solar sail idea is something that's been around for a long, long time. In fact, I have an article on from Popular Science back in the 50s talking about solar sails. We're still talking about fairly Stone Age technology compared to what's out there in the universe. And because of recent discoveries of the God particle and more recently gravity waves, we have the ability to travel at incredibly faster speeds. The limiting factor, for example, on the solar sail is mass. The heavier the object of the spacecraft becomes, the harder it is to accelerate, the harder it is to get it up to speed.
Which is exactly why Professor Lubin is focusing on these small sizes that will be so light that getting them up to 25% to 30% of the speed of light in minutes is absolutely feasible. They know that this is not a hard problem. And then is the excitement. Really, this is the part that has emerged just in the last 10 years that makes this so exciting, and that is the so-called iPhone technology, meaning the compacting of so much sophisticated technology in a small space that could go on this wafer spacecraft and go at 25%, 30% the speed of light, and really could be at Alpha Centauri in 17 years, sending back tremendous amounts of information to Earth the entire time.
I wouldn't want to take that trip, Linda. Would you? 17 years in a spaceship?
Well, I don't know, but that would be at the end of this century or getting into the next century, because you've got the
robots
and
size
robots of humans. But in the meantime, I think it's terrifically exciting to think about exploring the cosmos with these kinds of wafer spacecrafts that are going to be sending back so much information and maybe finding out why the universe seems silent to us, because there's something we haven't found.
Let's go to John in Athens, Alabama. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
Hey, I have just a couple quick questions. I'll take my answer off the air. Maybe sounds kind of silly, but I'm curious, how are we going to steer something like this? We're shooting something with a laser or photons. We have to be shooting in a straight line. And my next question is, why couldn't we put a laser on this thing to propel itself?
Steering and the laser. Go.
All right. Well, I'm telling you, I love you guys that are coming in
with
these really cool questions.
Couple minutes to go, Linda.
And I will have more discussions with Professor Lubin about this. He and I are working on an illustration. And I will try to get very specific answers to that question of a direction and could it carry its own laser. And I will keep reporting at earthfiles.com. So you guys who are asking these good questions, go to Earth Files, and you will find answers from Professor Lubin there in the next day two or three.
Joe in the Bronx, let's squeeze you in here. Joseph,
hey,
go ahead.
George, how are you?
Good
show. Now, Linda, I wanted to ask you, now, as far as the role of light is concerned in UFO travel, how important do you think that light could be for UFOs to traverse the universe? And also, I read a book a long time ago called Beam Riders, where individuals were able to ride beams of light through space.
Well, it's another very good question. I would say that if, in fact, the guy from MIT who was working on ring lasers was correct back in the 80s, that we're dealing with intelligences that can bend space-time, they have control on gravity, then we are not talking about being limited to 186,000 miles a second. If you can bend space-time, you're moving point to point. It's like a whole other order.
Linda, in a minute that we have left, give everybody info about where you're going to be and where they can show up.
Thank you. I'm at Eureka Springs at the Ozark UFO Conference. Gorgeous spring there, April 8th through 10th, 2016. I'm the keynote speaker on the evening of Friday, and Eric von Doniken is the keynote speaker on Saturday. So he and I will be complementing each other with our keynotes. And I will be in Dulce, New Mexico, May 14 to 15, talking about what may or may not be underground there. Ooh. And then June 3 to 6, the wonderful Contact in the Desert in Joshua Tree. It's been exciting the last 2 years I've been there. This year they're talking about even more people, more everything. And, George, it can be fantastic. It's going to be that first week in June. The weather, if it's nice, those breezes there are some of the best in the world.
We're celebrating my birthday that weekend out there, Linda.
All right. Well, maybe we can cheer with champagne together.
It'll be fun, huh? Linda Moltenau, thank you so much. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galanti, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.